Yeah, we might start. Thank you. Professor Capon, I'd like to thank you for your interest in the inquiry and for travelling to Perth to appear at today's hearing. The purpose of this hearing is to assist me in gathering evidence for the Climate Health WA inquiry into the impact of climate change on health in Western Australia. I'll begin by introducing myself for the record. My name is Taran Wiramantri and I've been appointed by the Chief Health Officer to undertake the inquiry. Beside me is Dr. Sarah Joyce, the inquiry's project director. If everyone could please be aware that the use of mobile phones and other recording devices is not permitted in this room. And so please make sure that your phone is on silent or switched off. This hearing is a formal procedure convened under Section 231 of the Public Health Act 2016. While you are not being asked to give your evidence under oath or affirmation, it is important you understand that there are penalties under the Act for knowingly providing a response or information that is false or misleading. This is a public hearing and a transcript of your evidence will be made for the public record. If you wish to make a confidential statement during today's proceedings, you should request that that part of your evidence be taken in private. You have previously been provided with the inquiry's terms of reference and information on giving evidence to the inquiry. Before we begin, do you have any questions about today's hearing?
No, I don't. Thank you, Dr. Wiramantri.
Could I ask you just to state your name and capacity in which you are here today?
Yes, my name is Professor Tony Capon, and I'm the director of the Monash Sustainable Development Institute.
Thank you. Professor Capon, would you like to make a brief opening statement?
Yes, I'd just like to acknowledge the importance of this inquiry for Australia and for the people of Australia and future Australians, because the health impacts of climate change are increasingly well understood, and it's really important that all of our tiers of government think about what this means for the way they do their business. So I commend the work of the inquiry and appreciate it.
Thank you. This is good timing for this hearing in terms of the release of a couple of recent reports.
Yes.
And so if we could start with the 2019 report of the Lancet Countdown on Health and Climate Change, which was released on November the 16th. And that's the international or global report. And part of its title was ensuring that the health of a child today is not defined by a changing climate. The choice of those words suggests a narrative of some sort. So can I ask you, what is the story being told and what are the methods that underpin that story globally?
Yes, thanks very much for that question. As you say, this time of year is now an important time of year in the field of health and climate change, because each year the Lancet Countdown is publishing a report on the tracking of progress on health and climate change around the world. And they'll be continuing to do this through until 2030 at least. The core theme this year in the report is that we need to be thinking much more clearly about what our decisions now and in the future mean for the health of children and the health of future generations, for people more generally. And this has clearly been inspired by the work of people like Greta Thunberg and other young people around the world who are trying to get the decision makers to act more urgently on climate change to protect and promote future health. The report essentially makes the case that if we don't change, a child born today may experience a world that's 4 degrees warmer than the pre-industrial age. That's a remarkable transformation and, again, a case for more urgent action. The reason that the Lancet makes this case is that children are among the worst affected by climate change already and into the future, whether it's declines in food productivity, food security, undernutrition. And which can have permanent effects, of course, in children, whether that's permanent physical effects, stunting, and intellectual development implications. Children are also more susceptible to diarrheal disease, to the more severe forms of dengue, to the health impacts of air pollution and extreme weather events, whether they're extreme heat events and other types of extreme weather events. So that's a core message of the report. But importantly, there is another narrative in the report, and that is that the future for a child born today could be quite different if we do act and take effective action in line with the Paris Agreement, aiming to keep the warming well below 2 degrees. That would require the phase out of coal as rapidly as is practical, and greater uptake of electric vehicles, resulting in cleaner air in our cities, safer cities, and by reducing the extent of climate change, helping to prevent those consequences for the food system. The report found that there has been some progress, that in countries like China, for example, we're starting to see a decline in the share of energy that is made by the burning of coal. We're seeing increases in renewable energy uptake, and we're seeing increases in electric vehicle uptake in some parts of the world. But an underlying message is that the response is still inadequate.
If I could just take you to a couple of points that I picked out, and there's
yes.
a lot of information in the report. First is that this international collaboration builds on 3 decades of work around the world. And I think you started off by saying in the opening statement something around the well-established links between health and climate change. Can you just talk about that kind of depth of experience? Because some people will hear this as a new issue.
Yes, and that's a very important point, in fact. And Australia is very relevant here, because the Australian environmental epidemiologist, Tony McMichael, was the first epidemiologist to make clear the relationships between health and climate change. And one of his books, Planetary Overload, was published in 1993, more than 25 years ago now. And around that time, Tony McMichael left Australia. He had been based at the University of Adelaide to a new base at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine in the UK, where he established a world-leading program on health and climate change, and spent a further decade based there in London, working very closely with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, to bring health into their reporting and tracking processes. So as you can see from that, there is quite a history in the work. Australia is very relevant. And since that time, there have been research groups established in leading universities around the world. And as you note, they are represented in the authorship of this global report from all regions of the world now. There is some insufficient research money in this space, and I'm well aware, as you are, Taryn, that NHMRC is thinking through at the moment, you know, what the options might be to ensure that there is sufficient investment in research and the development of sufficient research capacity in this country and more widely around the world.
So we'll come to the Australian report in a second, but I'm also keen to really encourage people to read the international report, because it puts the Australian report in some context.
Yes.
And so just as an example of that, indicator 1.2 on health and extreme weather events talks about wildfires across the globe. And, you know, we're obviously focused on bushfires in Australia at the moment, but this finding says that 152 of 196 countries saw an increase in the annual daily population exposure to wildfires in recent years compared to earlier part of the century. So that kind of comparative data that is important. That's quite a remarkable number of countries who are reporting. Would you like to talk about the kind of coverage of this international report?
Yes, the report aims to be as comprehensive in terms of inclusiveness of countries around the world, but clearly that's limited by the availability of data. So for some indicators, it's possible to get better data than for others. But part of the reporting process is to continually improve the data and the tracking processes as well. But as you say, I mean, here in Australia at the moment, certainly on the east side of Australia, we're very concerned about the coming fire season. And it's brought it home, I think, in Australia into much sharper focus this year.
Thank you. Just a couple of other quick points. On page 1871 of the Lancet publication, it talks about the climate change health links discussions being actually led internationally by small island developing states. So that's obviously relevant to Australia given its position in the Indo-Pacific.
Yes, and in fact, tonight I've just come in from Suva in Fiji, where we have a research program funded by the Wellcome Trust, looking at water supply and sanitation in informal settlements in Fiji and nature-based interventions to protect health in that context. And it's clear that people living in small, low-lying island countries in our region on the Pacific side, but also on the Indian Ocean side here, are among the most vulnerable in the world. And so it's great that they are having a stronger voice in the discussions. And disappointing, I think, for many Australians that we as a country are not responding comprehensively to these challenges. We're partially responding in terms of investing in supporting adaptation in these contexts, but we're not reflecting on our own behaviour and its flow-on impacts for people in other countries. And here, I guess, the most obvious example is that we seemingly continue to rely on the selling of coal to other countries for a substantial part of our export income, when there are alternatives for that if we embraced a transition to renewable energy. Clearly, we can't stop this overnight, but we have to start planning for it. And that is possible. And it's important that our governments engage in this discussion.
Professor Capelum, at the same time as the international report was released, you were a co-author of a linked Medical Journal of Australia Lancet report on health and climate change in Australia. Can you talk us through some of the main findings of that report that relate to the terms of reference of this inquiry? This inquiry being focused on the health sector and Western Australia.
Yes, this the NJA Lancet Countdown Report is another annual tracking process. Notably, it's the first nationally downscaled tracking process as a partnership with the Lancet Global Countdown. And I guess as a sidebar, the fact that we were able to commence this process 2 years ago is really part of Tony McMichael's legacy in Australia, because with his very important work over decades, he built capacity around the country. And so in each state, there is at least one active group working on health and climate change, including leading figures here in Western Australia. So with my colleagues, Paul Beggs and Ying Zhang, Paul, a geographer based at Macquarie University in Sydney, and Ying, a public health physician based at the Sydney School of Public Health. I established this collaboration when I came back from the UN in 2016. And this is the second of the reports in the tracking process. The subtitle of this year's report, A Turbulent Year with Mixed Progress, it reflects the political context this year in Australia with our national election, with some strong focus on climate change, reflecting the increasing concern among Australian people about climate change, including its health impacts. Some of the things we found this year include that vulnerability to heat-related extremes from climate change continue to increase, and this partially reflects an ageing population in Australia, the prevalence of chronic diseases among older people, and the fact that the majority of Australians, about 90% in fact, the vast majority, live in urban areas where there is potential for particular risks from extreme heat in the context of the urban heat island. And we of course see this in Greater Perth. And I know there are concerned public health professionals here in Perth about the impact of the urban heat island in the context of a changing climate on health. It's getting hotter in Australia, and we're concerned about the intensity, duration and frequency of heat waves. Wildfire exposure, we've already referred to in the global report, also extremely important here in Australia, and notably mental health impacts, which we have an indicator for in the Australian report that is not yet reported globally, and that reflects some expertise in Australia in this area of mental health. And it might be something we could explore a bit more later in this conversation. In terms of adaptation planning, we did note this year that the Queensland government now has a plan for climate change and health, and as I mentioned at the outset, it's very good to see this current inquiry from the WA government, but not sufficient engagement at the national level and not all the states as active as they might be. We are seeing leadership from cities though, and that's positive. In terms of health sector emissions, as you know, it's been estimated that 7% of all Australia's carbon emissions are attributable to the work of the health system, the hospitals, the other healthcare services, the general practices, the pharmaceuticals and medical devices that we use in the formal health system. And I think this is an area where there is great opportunities for us to do further work, and we're delighted that Professor David Pynchon will be visiting Australia next year, and I understand that he may have the opportunity to meet with this inquiry down the track. The public and political engagement, I guess in essence, we would say increasing public concern, but as yet that's not translating into the political engagement that we need to see. Although it was notable that just last week the Shadow Health Minister for Australia spoke at the City of Sydney about health and climate change when he gave a lecture at in the Faculty of Economics. So, you know, a beginning of political engagement, but we need to see a lot more. This is not a party political issue. I think we would all agree that all parties have failed us in this context, and we need them all to step up.
Professor Capon, thank you for that. Can I take you to box two, which is climate change and health attribution? So in our public presentations that we've done at forums in Western Australia, we've made the distinction between climate and weather.
Yes.
And weather being a one-off event and climate being a pattern. But you often see the question asked, can any one event be attributed to climate change? Which seems to me to be a somewhat curious mixture of a question about a single event and a question about a pattern, and possibly isn't quite the right framing of the question. But you also address this issue through some methodological work, which may be, you know, in progress. Could you tell us about your thinking about extreme event attribution?
Yes, this work is being led by our colleagues from the University of New South Wales, where there is a national centre on climate science. And it comes to the heart of that question of how much of, for example, the heat impacts on health are attributable to a changing climate as against to an established pattern. And clearly this has become a bit of a distraction in many ways in Australia. As health people, what I often say is that our role is not to become experts on climate, weather, climate science, changes in climate. Our responsibility is to protect and promote the health of people in the context of the exposures they have from climate exposures as they exist and what is changing and what may change further in the future. So the question of how many of these events are attributable is really outside my wheelhouse, if you like, but my responsibility is to do my best and with our colleagues, whether they're in government or in universities or elsewhere, to protect and promote health in this context. One thing I would say is that my colleague Tony McMichael, who I've referred to before, his view was that the important message was that when we're thinking about things like heat extremes, these are being amplified by climate change. We don't need to be obsessed, if you like, by the attribution of a particular event, but they're being amplified in frequency, intensity and duration by climate change. And that's what's important in terms of preparedness for the future and the urgency of the response.
Just going back to the mental health indicator, section 1.5 of your report, and you said that this is an indicator in the Australian report but not in the international one as yet. And it's quite complicated and complex data.
Yes.
Hard to kind of pitch into a single message, lots of variables in there. For the purposes of the inquiry, possibly the importance is that we have picked up a range of descriptions of mental health effects, which we will put into the final report in people's own words. But it's, I suppose the importance of this is that there is a mental health indicator being developed, even though it's not perfect. How do you approach this kind of issue?
Yes, when I think about the mental health impacts of climate change, I often think about relationships between people's lives, their livelihoods and their well-being. And so if we talk about one potential pathway that I think many people in Australia are very concerned about, with the prolonged drought that we're seeing on the East Coast at the moment, but also in other parts of the country, we're seeing drying of the soil in that context, declines in agricultural productivity in many regions, and that means that there's declining incomes for farmers and declining incomes in farming communities. And this has flow-on implications for the mental health of farmers and farming communities. And as you know, we're concerned about rates of depression, rates of suicide in farming communities, not just in Australia, but in India and elsewhere around the world. And so that's how I think about mental health in this context, that it's, if you like, it's a flow-on consequence of the sorts of changes that we're seeing, loss in the context of extreme weather events, whether it's a cyclone in North Queensland, for example, or the northwest here of Western Australia, the loss that's associated with that, whether it's the loss of material possessions, or whether it's loss of lives, or whether it's disability that may result from injuries in that context. There are mental health implications from these changes that we're seeing.
So I might pick up on that whole issue of just going from mental health to, if you like, media reporting. And you've seen in Australia in the last few years a greater consistent focus on mental health as an issue. And picking up on section 5.1 of your Lancet countdown in both internationally and in the Australian report, it's media coverage of health and climate change. Now, your data goes to mainly 2018, and you can, and but there's more recent data which shows a more a pickup in media coverage in 2019, particularly following the release of the IPCC 1.5 report. And maybe the other societal things. So I was struck by the fact that initiatives such as Covering Climate Now, which is a media initiative across media organisations to give a more consistent evidence-based coverage to climate, is leading to a kind of a greater focus and consistency of media coverage as opposed to the episodic coverage in prior years. And maybe there's a lesson there in terms of the health sector's attention to this issue needs to become more consistent, because what we've seen, I believe, is an episodic attention of the health sector to this issue. Sorry, yes. That's a long, long preamble to the question, which is there a lesson we can learn from how the media is covering climate change now to how the health sector needs to give consistent attention to this issue?
Yes, I think that's a very important point, because we do in public health tend to be reactive to crises. That's understandable. So when we have an extreme weather event, for example, a heat wave period perhaps combined with fires and air pollution, or whether it's a prolonged drought, you know, we pay attention during that time. But once that period passes, then we do sometimes return to, if you like, business as usual in the way we work. And so I think it is critical that climate and weather and its implications for health becomes a core part of the way we do business in health and in the health system. And one of the things that we're working on at the moment is how do we bring this into health worker education, whether that's medical education or whether it's other health workers, so that we improve the capacity and the capability of the workforce to bring this into their day-to-day work. It's quite interesting, in fact, if you reflect back historically, 2,000 years ago or more in ancient Greece, Hippocrates, of course, considered the father of our profession of medicine, was writing books, including a book called On Airs, Waters and Places. So Hippocrates, 2,000 years ago, was speaking to his patients. He was thinking of how they lived and where they lived, and he was making ecological deductions about the relationships between weather, climate and health in that context. And if we fast forward to now, we've certainly got remarkable new technologies in medicine, in biomedicine. We've got new toxicological methods. We've got new genomic methods. We've got new epidemiological methods. We're very well equipped. But perhaps we've left some things behind as well, left those learnings that we need to reclaim and bring them more centrally and back into our work in what we might call an eco-social understanding of health to complement biomedical understanding. It's not to say that biomedical is unimportant. It's to say that eco-social is also important. We've been quite good at the social determinants of health, but we've seemingly forgotten the ecological determinants, whether it's climate stability, whether it's biodiversity, including microbiological diversity, whether it's ecosystems more generally. These are fundamental for human health, well-being and flourishing, and we need to reclaim that and make it more central in the way we practice health and medicine in this country and around the world.
So trying to reflect and learn, as you said, could you perhaps reflect on your time between, I think it is between 2009 and 2011, when you were the founding convener of the National Climate Change Adaptation Research Facility, funded Research Network for Human Health. What were its main outputs? Because we've seen some in Western Australia when we've gone and kind of canvassed the literature. And what useful lessons could be applied today? And part of the reason I'm asking is that we have heard from others in this series of hearings that momentum in this area was lost in Australia after that and could be and needs to be quickly regained.
Yes, the NCAR funding that was provided to eight different sectoral networks back in 2009 give an impetus to more engagement by researchers around the country. And I was greatly honoured to be the founding convener for the network that was established for human health and climate change based at ANU, where Tony McMichael was my mentor. So I think one of the key things that came from that work was the importance of being clear that there are quite an array of health implications from climate change. And we categorise these into three broad groupings. The direct health impacts, which, if you like, are the most evident. The health impacts of extreme weather events, for example, whether they're heat waves, tropical storms and cyclones, droughts, bushfires. It's clear that those extreme weather events can claim lives, and they can also cause injuries and other harms to health. So that's relatively readily understandable. And the broader question becomes, how do you protect health in that context? How do you strengthen emergency preparedness frameworks, and that public health and chief health officers have a key role in already. The second category are the indirect health impacts of climate change, and we divided these into three subcategories. The first of these were the changes to physical systems and processes, and perhaps a good example of that would be air pollution. So in a city like Perth, on any given day, there is a level of air pollution that comes, much of it, from the motor car and other vehicles that are used to transport people and goods around the city. And so where does climate fit into that? Well, the weather conditions on the day affect the extent of the air pollution. For example, on a particularly hot day, we get higher levels of ozone formation at the ground level, and this has a potential for greater health impacts for people, for example, children with asthma. So it's an interaction between a physical system that's already operating in the city and a changing climate. And so this is one example of a change to a physical system and process where climate change is relevant. The second subcategory of indirect health impacts are the changes to biological systems and processes. And here we might point to potential health risks from mosquitoes and other vectors. So potential for changing distribution and abundance of mosquito vectors, which can carry a range of potential pathogens for humans. The third subcategory are the broader changes to ecosystem structure and function. And this might be, for example, constraints on microbes and the potential from changing climate and their relevance to new infectious diseases more generally. The final category of health impacts of climate change are what we call the flow-on effects for health from climate change. And I alluded to these when we were speaking about mental health before. So we have those direct pathways to health. We have those three categories of indirect pathways to health. But all of those impacts have additional consequences, often mediated through changes to people's incomes, potential for loss of livelihoods in this context, and also potential for displacement. We referred to low-lying communities before, whether that's low-lying communities here in WA or in our neighbouring countries, and what that might mean in terms of Australia's policies to provide a safe haven for people from our region who may need to move as a result of a changing climate. So that was one thing that came from the work we did with that network, was really exploitating that further and engaging our researchers and policymakers in the extent of the challenges so that we can get our head around it. We also, helped to make the case for new funding on research in this space, working closely with the NHMRC and CSIRO, who were well engaged at this time in health and climate change research. There were a number of published outputs, and including themed issues of Australian journals. The New South Wales Public Health Bulletin was one example, and the Asia Pacific Journal of Public Health had a supplement in 2011. There was at the time, I think, quite a lot of media interest, policy interest, and one on the positive side of all of this, the health and climate change positive story, if you like, the co-benefits for health from the transition to sustainable ways of living. We hosted a conference at the Australian Academy of Science in June 2010 on precisely this theme, and there's a themed issue that flowed from that as well. So it was really, that network was an effort to stimulate more interest and engagement from as wide a community of scholars and policymakers as we could.
So you mentioned a couple of the academic outputs there.
Yes.
Amongst a number of other outputs. And so can you reflect, based on your involvement with environmental and climate issues over many years, can you reflect on the links and or boundaries between academics and academic institutions on the one hand and advocacy groups on the other?
Yes, I mean, this is often brought up as, it seems that people feel that, that academics shouldn't be involved in advocacy. It's quite interesting to reflect on that from a public health point of view, and particularly where I was based at the University of Sydney, where there's been a long history of advocacy in public health including around tobacco and its health harms. People like Professor Simon Chapman, for example, very eminent Australian public health advocate, and there is a science of advocacy and how you achieve the change, because for many things, we already have the knowledge. We need to focus more on how we achieve the change in that context. And so when I think about the role of academics, I think we have three broad responsibilities. First is to build knowledge. And in this context, I think policy relevant knowledge is enormously important. Secondly, we need to be working to build capacity, whether that's for professionals who are already in the system, or whether it's for future generations through the training courses in university. But importantly, we need to show leadership and engage, and that requires advocacy. We have to speak out. And this would historically have been called perhaps the public intellectual responsibility of an academic, and platforms like The Conversation provide a structure as a basis for some of that advocacy. But there's no doubt in my mind that all academics have responsibility to speak out, because we don't want the findings just being inside the academy, people talking to each other. It's very much about engaging with people who are making decisions and supporting those people as best we can.
So we've just got a few minutes left. I've just got one last question for you to consider. It kind of goes back to your starting point, which is about there's an urgency to act. And this report comes out in, will be given to the Minister in early 2020. We've been asked to provide a path forward for the health sector in Western Australia. And that's where our conclusions and recommendations will go. And we're certainly thinking of framing it in terms of the next decade. And that's a kind of convenience from a 2020 to 2030 kind of perspective, fits in with the IPCC 1.5 report. And I think others are thinking in terms of similar framing of this as an issue. Is that a useful framing for you? Because clearly there'll need to be work done after that, you know, and every bit makes a difference. And I've seen some slight recent criticism of that framing as potentially saying, you know, it's all or nothing, and that can be dangerous in itself. Have you reflected on that at all?
Yes, I think we have to be sophisticated enough to think at different time horizons. I mean, the global report of the Lancet Countdown encourages to think ahead to the life of a child born today, which hopefully in this country would be 80 plus years. So the Lancet report's wanting us to think that far ahead, but also to think what we need to do now. You know, when we wake up in the morning and we come to our job in the WA Health Department or another agency of government in this country, what can we be doing today to improve the situation for people currently alive, but also for people about to be born? So I think 10 years is realistic. I think governments can often think that far ahead. It doesn't always have to be about the next election cycle. And we have had some leaders, I made the comment earlier, that our governments have failed us, and I think clearly that's a generalisation. But there are some very thoughtful people in all parliaments of Australia, and we need to be supporting those people, working with them. Recently, you'd be likely aware that in the Australian Parliament, there's a re-established group on Friends of Climate Action, and those folk come from all parties, from all, including the independents. And so I think one of the strengths of an inquiry like this focused on health and climate change is it needn't be political, because we all have to reflect on these things. By bringing a health lens to climate and climate change, it helps us understand the urgency. These people are already being affected. People are already dying in these extreme weather events that are being amplified in frequency and intensity. So So it helps us understand the urgency. It helps us personalize the problem. So we don't think of climate as an abstract thing, climate change as an abstract future thing, because it makes it real, it makes it personal. And there are personal stories to tell and stories to understand how we can help. And thirdly, the health and climate change message is useful because we can turn it around. There's a positive story to tell if we do act urgently and effectively. And that's the other message from this year's Lancet Countdown report, that we needn't leave a legacy of 4 degrees of warming. It is still possible for us to change. And here just yesterday and today in WA, there's the Resources Technology Showcase about possible futures and economic opportunity for people in Western Australia, including for young people. And if we had more time to talk today, I'd offer some reflections on Ross Garnaut's new book, you know, Superpower, Australia's Low Carbon Opportunity, which is really about the possibilities and the livelihoods for future generations of Australians, which will support their health and well-being if we embrace this change. Because there are opportunities here, business opportunities, that we need to seize. And if we don't have the conversations, then we'll miss those opportunities. And that'll be another bad legacy, not just a much warmer climate, but also missed economic opportunities for future generations of West Australians and other Australians.
Mr. Capon, thank you very much for your attendance at today's hearing. A transcript of this hearing will be sent to you so that you can correct minor factual errors before it is placed on a public record. If you could please return the transcript within 10 working days of the date of the covering letter or email, otherwise it will be deemed to be correct. While you cannot amend your evidence, if you would like to explain particular points in more detail or present further information, you can provide this as an addition to your submission to the inquiry when you return the transcript. And once again, thank you very much for the evidence.
Thank you very much, Dr. Weir.